The Sutra of the Heart of Transcendent Knowledge, the
Thank you.
So, okay, we were talking about how we just, it's on the second page here where we talk about how bodhisattvas basically abide in prajnaparamita and in discussion and in doing the prajnaparamita, which is the perception of the basic nature of reality itself. they discover basically there's no obscuration of mind and no fear. They transcend falsity, or they transcend the notion of they actually can see through because they're not engaged in trying to fool anybody and put anything over on either themselves or anything else. They're just willing to be here and see it as it is. And they attain complete nirvana, which we did discuss that, which is basically, did we? Relaxation into the expanse of awareness, ultimately. Okay? That's a simple way of putting it right now. It's a resolution of the fundamental problem, which is suffering. We call it suffering. And the suffering, as we understood it, we can understand it, has to do with anxiety and confusion and a feeling of being separate from what is. Being separate, and the separation causes a lot of pain and causes a lot of fundamental bewilderment. So, now, the meaning of the three times, the Buddhas of the three times, is past, present, and future. That's what we're talking about here when we talk about the Buddhas of the three times. The Buddhas who have come in the past, who are in the present world, and who will come after us. They all, by means of prajnaparamita, fully awaken to unsurpassable, true, complete enlightenment. So, that means they are fully realized in terms of understanding nature of mind. And in that, they have at least, from an outsider point of view, attained perfect peace. It doesn't mean what it seems like from the outside, by the way. I mean, it doesn't mean it's just rosy-dosy.
And again, that is not necessarily... that enlightened state is not always present.
No, it is always present.
It is always
present. It is present now.
In a bodhisattva, I mean.
It is present now. The enlightened state is right here and now. What we are learning about in our practice is to open up to the fundamental enlightened state, which is intrinsic, innate, to really fully being present.
Maybe another way to put it is, it's present, but it's not always perceived.
Exactly. It doesn't mean we perceive it. So what we're doing in terms of both the practice of meditation and developing the skillful means to function is to actually acquire this capacity or drop the veils that fundamentally block us or obscure us from seeing really the truth, and also spontaneously responding or naturally responding in this present.
But the words, the bodhisattvas attain complete nirvana.
Yes. So when you recite this,
does that someone who is a bodhisattva,
yes,
different from who I am? I mean, I always thought there were enlightened beings, people who really had attained that state of...
Suzuki Roshi was this great Zen teacher who lived, he died about 1972 or 71. He was in San Francisco. He was a very wonderful Japanese Zen master who came. He said, when we practice, we are the Buddha. The way we have to view our experience, when we sit, when we actually sit, the minute we begin to sit, we are the Buddha. So we don't try to separate ourselves from fundamental Buddhahood or what we would call complete enlightenment. Just simply accept that as a possibility and let that be something that would can give us a sense of confidence. Mm-hmm. He was speaking to ordinary people just like you and me who, you know, didn't have any special qualifications or anything else. So when we recite this, and that's why it's a practice to recite this, it's not just a nice thing to do, we are actually taking a vow to basically witness the truth, to actually practice prajnaparamita. That's why we recite it. When we recite a sutra, it actually allows us to enter the space of what the sutra means.
So does all the Buddhas of the three times mean all the people who've sat down and done this?
When they did it.
When they did it.
All of them. And so when we do it, we need to simply accept the possibility of being bodhisattvas. I mean, I don't think we would want to do this unless we had some interest in this in the first place.
Okay.
Of course, you could just get dragged here and wonder what you're doing. Don't worry about that.
But we're all writing Buddhas even before we
see this.
It's all the time.
This is the fundamental. The way the Mahayana we are studying, the Mahayana path, talks about this. It introduces the notion we are already Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody is Buddha. All sentient beings are Buddha, regardless of whether they know it or not. And so when we actually open ourselves up through prajnaparamita, we've been discussing what prajna is. Prajna is the sixth paramita.
Mm-hmm.
It is the perfection of the capacity, the perfection of seeing the nature of things, seeing reality, and it's also in itself wisdom. So when we practice prajna, we are practicing the wisdom of the Buddhas. We are practicing the wisdom of actually directly seeing what we call emptiness or shunyata. And that's one of the, and we all have this faculty. It's intrinsic to ourselves. Particularly human beings have this capacity. We know we have it because it's been discovered, and everyone who is interested can train in it. You have to be interested, by the way. Just as an aside. So, okay, then we're going to recite now. We're going towards the mantra itself, because when we say the mantra, we are going to actually engage in empowering. Mantra is actually a self-empowerment. When we practice, when we say a mantra of this nature in Sanskrit, these are Sanskrit words, I'll explain them, we're actually engaging in a very small but very fundamental empowerment. Empowering ourselves to this reality, to this wisdom, to this basic blessing that's intrinsic and into our own nature, to our own minds. So that's why we want to practice, and that's also why mantra practice is good, if we understand what it's about and give ourselves to it properly. So the mantra itself, the mantra of prajnaparamita, the great insight, which we were just discussing about the perfection, or the sixth perfection, which therefore then also raises the level of all the previous five paramitas, because basically it establishes everything in excellence and basically awakened mind. And the mantra itself, which calms all suffering, because once we actually begin to understand what we're doing with this mantra, what this mantra does, is it cuts through all of the fetters of our knotted up patterns of mind that continually keep us from seeing and being true, seeing reality, being real, being genuine. We are talking, this is the correlation of what this means. We're talking about being genuine, being original. Actually understanding, accepting, and establishing ourselves in our original nature, which is completely pure. That's why we're talking about all beings being essentially Buddha. Okay? So, it should be known as truth, since there is no deception. So that's an interesting statement, isn't it? Well, no deception means basically things are really just what they are. Nobody's putting over anything on anyone. if we really simply are able to drop all of our expectations, projections, and anxieties around something, and letting it be. So, these are the instructions, right? This is what we're working on when we practice meditation and when we practice learning how to actually genuinely engender compassion, which we are going to be continuing to discuss. So don't worry about having it all figured out now. The Prajnaparamita mantra is said in this way. Om Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhi Swaha. So that means, Om, first of all, is in Sanskrit and in other languages too, by the way. There's a lot of words that don't have any kind of specific meaning, but they actually, like, wow is potentially a word in English. Hey, you know. You know, like, all kinds of words. And in Sanskrit, we have these words because they're somewhat exalted, because they're considered a bit, they're kind of like setting up an energy or opening up to an energy we have in ourselves. And also, we talk about the blessings of the lineage. We will go into that later, which is very important. But the Om is simply establishing this statement. Gate means gone. Gone. And it's past tense. It's past participle. Gate, paragate. Paragate means gone to the other shore. Gone, and then parasangate means gone beyond the other shore. Bodhi. Bodhi is awakened mind. Swaha is also a term that is like all hail or
so be it.
So be it.
Thus have I heard.
Thus it is, and it's also an exclamation. Mm-hmm. So we recite that.
You have a question down here.
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed Bodhi.
Bodhi?
What does that mean?
Awakened mind. Awakened mind, just so we'll know what we're talking about. Awakened mind is not up here. Awakened mind is here. When we talk about mind, this is where the seat of mind is. Okay? When we talk about awakened mind, we're talking about awakened heart. When we talk about empty mind, we're talking about empty heart. That's something we will discuss. This is part of the teachings that we're going to explore with this particular sutra. It's open, completely open, and it's completely present, completely warm, completely intelligent, and caring. Okay?
Thank you.
So, Om Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhi Swaha. Let's say that three times together.
Om Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhi Swaha. Om Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhi Swaha. Om Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhi Swaha.
And thus, Shariputra, the Bodhisattva, Mahasattva, should train in the profound Prajnaparamita. So all the things that have been discussed prior to this is actually training in the Prajnaparamita. And the Prajnaparamita is extremely profound. It's absolutely necessary. Without prajna, we cannot really understand. We experience emptiness. We experience what we call gap or space, open space, but we don't understand it. You know, it's like you could say when we first practice meditation, it's just a space between the thoughts. Well, you know, it's just there, kind of like neutral. Okay, no big deal. You know, as we learn how to get more acquainted and more spacious and looser and more open in our practice, then it gets richer. It starts. It's not just some kind of a vacuum. It's not some kind of a vast empty desert devoid of any kind of life. It is life. So you know, we can go into a lot of different aspects of how that could be, but right now we'll just keep it at that. Then the Blessed One arose from that samadhi. So back again, we discussed last week, he'd gone into this samadhi. The Blessed One is
the Buddha,
historical Buddha. We are talking about this as being Shakyamuni Buddha, who gave this teaching at Bhotra Peak Mountain in India to a gathering of monks and bodhisattvas. And as we mentioned, because what he said was so radical to the people who had not been prepared to work with us, they had heart attacks, or many of them did, because they were just working on perfecting themselves and making themselves wonderful people and getting out of all their pain and suffering. And suddenly he's saying, wait a minute, you don't even exist, you know. And not only that, nothing else does. And that was just too much. So they keeled over. Or else they decided, all right, I'm going for this.
Or they left.
Yeah, but they spent years. We're talking about people who spent years swearing off the world, swearing off all of their desires, suppressing and, doing everything they could to find antidotes to all their negative thoughts and everything else, and getting themselves set up on this little platform of, control. And, he's saying, wait a minute, you don't. It's all completely beyond, you, beyond anybody's kind of idea of anything. And that was really too much for some people. What we're learning about is complete openness does not have any presuppositions or any expectations. Openness is openness. It's innocence. It's actually innocence. Primal innocence. And there's no guilt involved. Nothing to escape from, nothing to make up from. There's nothing to remediate. We're not trying to make up for all of our bad deeds. We're actually just completely here, now, fresh, open. Okay?
Good.
So he praised Bodhisattva Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara. That is Kuan Yin in Chinese, in case people don't know or didn't know that. Major Bodhisattva. Good, oh son of noble family. And if it was Kuan Yin, he'd say, oh daughter of noble family, because thus it is, one should practice the profound prajnaparamita just as you have taught, and all the Tathagatas will rejoice. So the Tathagatas are the Buddhas themselves. The word in Tibetan is Deshin Shekpa, meaning gone to bliss. It's basically, the Tathagatas are those who have gone beyond basically the need to recycle themselves. Mm-hmm. There's nobody left to worry about coming back and fixing themselves up and making up for some past transgression or anything else. In other words, they completely transcended the trap of the thought of time, and time is thought. So they've actually been able to discover a complete open freedom. Mm. And that's what we're talking about. So then, when the Tathagatas, when one experiences this openness, you realize that actually the state of enlightenment, something precedes enlightenment. It's called liberation. And so while we could say on a very profound level that everything is intrinsically liberated for in itself, whether it knows it or not, liberated from its own trappings or confusion. It doesn't know that. But at that point, there is a tremendous amount of freedom and exaltation. But going beyond that is actually enlightenment itself. And that's when all the Tathagatas are in a state of rejoicing. It is something to celebrate. It is fundamentally wonderful. It's wonderment. One of the great lamas of the 14th century, one of the most profound people who walked the face of the earth, Longchenpa, basically talked about, one of his works talked about just the stage of basically relaxing into the truth, into this fundamental ground, and he said it's called wonderment. Mm-hmm. And because there's almost no words, and there are really no words for it. So you can call it wonderment, because it's more interesting than calling it, I don't know.
Cool.
Yeah, cool, dude.
Cool, man.
Okay, so then the Blessed One had said this, and Venerable Shariputra, and Shariputra, again, in case you didn't know, was this constant nerd who was always trying so hard to do everything. He could never rest. He could never lighten up. He was always the first person to raise his hand in any kind of historical Buddhist teaching. And, you know, will you please explain this and that? Of course, he's very important because, you know, this is the spur that causes all these questions to be asked, and you get the answers, right? The questions are provoking the answers. So he's an essential nerd, we'll say, or a jerk. I mean, the truth about Shariputra is, at least according to Zen tradition, is at one point he could never sleep because he was so anxious about trying to understand everything.
Oh, wow.
And finally, at one point, he actually did fall asleep, and at that point it happened. It all he collapsed because he gave up. He relaxed. And that was the liberation of Shariputra.
Yes, but on the other hand, he had the courage to ask a question.
Oh, yeah.
And that is of great importance, that teachers can't teach unless someone asks a question. And when you ask a question, it takes courage, and you're asking it, even though you're afraid you're a fool, you ask the question, and you are helping not only yourself, but everyone else. It's also generous that you put yourself at risk to ask a question.
And you're benefiting the teacher as well, because the teacher is actually learning from the student. That's something that's absolutely the case.
Yeah, Plato depended on the same words to get his message across.
Yay, nerds.
So, at this point, all of these beings and the whole assembly and the world with gods, humans, asuras. Asura is considered a wrathful or titan. It's a wrathful god, jealous god, who's always trying to usurp the gods. They always want to take over because they look at how good the gods have it. These are in this kind of a spiritual dimension. And they always lose, but they always wage these battles. They can never give up. They really try hard. And they're really brilliant. But they're not really, they haven't figured out how to relax. And Gandharvas are...
Wait a minute.
Is this representing something? I mean, what are you saying?
They're beings of the six realms. We have a desire realm. When we talk about the six realms, I don't know... So the six realms consist of demons or hell beings, pretas, hungry ghosts, animals, then humans. And humans are considered the three lowest, and then the humans are the first of the higher realms. And then above humans are asuras. And then above those are gods. But humans are a unique situation because humans actually encounter a lot more disappointment. Mm. And so they actually ask questions.
Yeah.
They can question what they're doing. All these other beings are so absorbed in their situation that they just cycle over and over again until their karma works out. Mm. It's all karmic when we're talking on this level. Which is another topic. The whole assembly of Gandharvas. Gandharva has a couple of different meanings. One meaning in Hindu mythology is they are musical gods. They're beings who kind of like hover over, you know, when you have musical experiences and you resonate and you have this kind of elevated or raptures or that quality.
Connecting with the muse.
Yeah, connecting with this kind of vibratory quality of that's the Gandharvas, but then also Gandharvas are known as bardo beings. They're someone who's in the bardo, who's going in between lifetimes, becomes in searching or having to work out going to the next step. If you missed the absolute, if you missed getting it when you know shortly after you die, then all this stuff starts happening and you start believing in this stuff. And the next thing you know is because, you know, you're not recognizing your nature of mind that you end up becoming a bardo being looking for another life.
Wow. Okay.
So there are
I'll get more about that
they
later.
Are all this.
Sort of comment, which is, you know, in Trungpa's writing, he talks about the realms in a much more metaphorical way. And I'm wondering whether to be using, you know, like he talks about some of the individual quest as being a sequence through the realms. And you know, I think that's in the spiritual materialism book. And so but there's also the very literal description in the Tibetan cosmology. Are you using that interpretation?
I think we can use both. For instance, if you look at one of the books, he has Transcending Madness, which is an extraordinary book. really very different from, you know, and he did introduce the whole notion of the six realms of psychological states. And it's there's no question, as far as we are concerned, as far as our own experience is concerned, yes, we're working with these dimensions. You know, this is part of what it means. And so we do and can, we will encounter, you know, different points in our life where we will experience or could experience hell realm, hungry ghost realm, animal realm, and they all have a qualities associated with them. And so what we can learn from this is how basically we get trapped and how we get absorbed into a cycle of confusion. So, you know, Rinpoche was very good this way in terms of very skillful. Generally, if you ask traditional Tibetans, they talk specifically about there being these specific dimensions.
Yeah.
And you're going to end up there if you're not in the human realm. But, you know, I mean, for us, it makes much more sense to approach this psychologically. Just like when we go into these other stages of, for instance, working, and I'll just mention it, because you're going to read about it, you're going to find out about it. What we call deity practice. You know, we're not talking about connecting with deities out there. We are actually entering a state of mind. There are energies that we can actually, that are accessible in our own mind. So by the same token, these various states, they're states of mind. Okay?
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So, that's basically what the story. you may have questions, please feel free to, or discuss what's on your mind if you feel like it has any relevance.
Yeah, you said that you talked about the mantras. You called it a self-empowerment. I know what the words mean. What does that mean? You know, that specific phrase as opposed to the rest of the sutras. So
okay, we don't just isolate the mantra itself.
Okay.
We don't just walk around saying mantras because it sounds good. You know, we need to understand what, in this case, it's, and oftentimes it will be surrounded by a sutra. This is a short sutra. Some of them are quite long, others are quite short. But the idea is you understand what the context is of the mantra. And then once you do that, it's a way of steeping yourself in. So reciting gate, gate, paragate, parasangate is a way of actually reminding ourselves of what our interests are in this particular way. It's also a way of encouraging ourselves. It's a way of directing our mind somewhere. We want to direct our minds to this particular practice. And so practicing Prajnaparamita can actually be activated in some level by reciting the mantra. And of course, because it is Prajna, we don't just do that and wait for it to happen. I mean, we're exercising discrimination awareness all the time, discriminating awareness.
So the fact that the mantra is embedded in the sutra, sort of, can you think of the sutra as commentary on the mantra, or is that a little shallow?
Yeah, because, I mean, I'll tell you, there are different things called dharanis also, which are more complex mantras. But fundamentally, they're meant to basically energize a situation in a particular way. And we're accessing sort of like this bank of wisdom that kind of exists within us, in our potential, in everyone's potential. And so this is a key to get that door open and to enter that realm and actually become acquainted with it and work. So one of the suggestions is, for anybody who's interested, is to, you know, you can do recitations in your daily practice. You can do lineage supplications, and you can do the Heart Sutra. When we do this Four Dharma Sankalpa, we're doing that to remind us, we're actually requesting our innate wisdom mind to basically, when we say grant your blessings, we're not asking for some authority figure out there to give us the okay. Grant your blessings so that my mind may be one with the Dharma. We're asking our wisdom mind to actually, you know, open up to us so that we can actually be there with it, you know, actually make this connection. It's not just somewhere else. It's in us. That's the key point.
So I think the mantra is like the jewel in the lotus, that the lotus opens, and then the jewel is the mantra at the center of the actual sutra here. But the whole sutra has energy, and the whole thing is very empowering. So it gives the environment for this mantra, in which this mantra abides.
makes it richer altogether.
If you attend or watch how Anam Tupten conducts a meditation session, he will give instruction and meditation and get people down to a state of basic awareness and silence, and then have the mantra. He'll have people recite the mantra for 5 minutes, which is a lot.
Mm-hmm.
As you can say it many, many, many times until he stops it.
And they sing it.
Yeah, they sing it.
Mm-hmm.
Another way to do it.